Hi, Bruce, it's Lynn.
It's me. Lucky guess you picked the right number.
You're looking at a whole new approach to what belief really means and how belief can affect our lives in a much more positive and, shall I say, victimless fashion.
Religion claimed that everything was controlled by the invisible stuff. And when things seem to be out of control in the world and things go crazy, and then so the people in the black coats were saying, God and spirit did this, and be careful, and all that, a new group of people wearing white coats came in and said, but maybe I can understand it without putting the invisible stuff. Maybe it's possible that it's just a physical thing, and that instead of the religious view of invisible moving forces, which can be defined as spirit, instead of invoking spirits, let's just invoke this as a mechanical machine. When you go back to that ancient, darker world where there was no real science at that point, and phenomena of the planet and weather and people and everything were just such a mystery that you shrouded it, and you bought a belief because it seemed good at the time that there are spirits, that spirits are influencing this unfoldment. Now, here's where the problem comes from. The people who told you that story also added one little caveat. They said, we are the ones who speak to spirit. So now what do? Is they put the fear on the outside. They tell you, this fear is going to get you, but guess what? You can't get there
exactly
without me. And so that's how they manipulated the situation. They had everybody live in fear that the unknown was going to get them, but they, as mediators of the unknown, for a certain fee, which was kind of high,
yeah,
would do this interface and take care of it for you. And of course, the problem is, over the time, the church became more of a burden than a support, and that's what led to the Reformation. Even people who claim to be very religious, if they have a cancer, before they go to the priest, they'll go to the doctor. Oh, stand back. What does that mean? The answer is, they may claim religion is very important, but when it comes down to immediate threat on their life, let's go to the mechanical guy. He's the one that's going to do it. The whole issue with MS is an unfortunate situation. You could look at the immune system as being dysfunctional in either of two ways. Physically, mechanically, it just doesn't work. Or by program and instructions and direction, it's got some misinformation that keeps it from working.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two things. Either it's physically broken or there's something wrong in the information, right? And what's interesting is that in today's field of immunology, the leading edge at some point is an area called psychoneuroimmunology. Heard of that term, psychoneuroimmunology?
Well, I can sort of link them all together in my mind. I don't know if I've quite heard them put together like
that. Well, okay, and when you link them together, it's the same meaning that they had when they assembled it in the first place. The first one overrides the second, which then overrides the third, et cetera, and that's how you put them in a hierarchy.
Okay.
So immunology is the immune system, of course, and all the functioning mechanical parts of it. And then it's called neuroimmunology was the next level of it, when they started to identify that the brain function was connected to the immune system and that the brain was capable of regulating the immune system. It wasn't an autonomous thing. It was now under neurocontrol. When they added the psycho part, was that they realized that the psychology affected the neurology, which in turn affected the immune system. Really what it says is that a person's immune system is under the control primarily of a person's psychology.
Lynn Thompson here, the host and producer of the On Purpose podcast. Today, a special feature with Dr. Bruce Lipton. I had this long conversation by phone with Dr. Lipton in 2006, just after his book was released, The Biology of Belief. It's been updated since then, so I've gone through our conversation and tidied it up a little bit. Listen for what you can and then come back and pick up where you ended off. I started this next section by asking Dr. Lipton about the book, Biology of Belief. Enjoy.
It was turned down by the New York publishers because helping me interface with the public, they tried to inform me, you can't be against genes and Darwin. And therefore, they said, you know, pick one and leave the other one alone. And then we'll talk about publishing the book. And the reality is, the science is a science. I don't care. This is science. So after messing around with them for a year where they wanted me to keep rewriting the book, taking out the science, and it sort of was, that was not my intention. And then we self-published the book. So my partner, Margaret, put her money into it and published it. And therefore, we got much better results to tell the real science in spite of this overpower thing, you know, the moguls who run publishing who want you to publish in this little confined space for the people. It's sort of like, no, I want to open the door bigger, more information.
I commend you for persevering with your vision of it. I think it's a lovely production. In your credits here, in your acknowledgments, you mention the music by the group Yes.
Oh, God, I love those guys. It's always, as I wrote in there, it's like, I when writing this up, and I started hearing them years and years ago, that when I started to become more aware, I also started to recognize this group was saying a lot of things out of the ordinary rock and roll kind of story. They were talking about the light and the spirit and all this stuff, and I realized in the end, when my science started to make sense, it was exactly what they were singing about. And they say it in nice poetry in a few lines, and I have to spend chapters to bring it into the science.
Our traditional ways of thinking how we are influenced through our genes, it's actually going in the other direction, that influence, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, because we bought into the whole gene story is actually a story that was seeded back in 1859, Charles Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
In understanding the theory of evolution, what they were looking at were the characteristics of organisms and how they fit to their environment, etc. But the very obvious facts started to become clear to Darwin, who, like most people at that time, were involved with breeding plants and animals and stuff like that. I mean, that was just like a pastime for the people back then. No TV.
Right.
And what was interesting was that since the issue of evolution focused on the traits and the changes of traits, it was also suggested in the theory, then immediately accepted by everybody because they were breeding plants and animals, is that the traits are controlled by the parents, in a sense that an offspring reflects the traits of its parents. But what they did back in those days, because this was at the time of beginning of focusing only on the material reality, the Newtonian character, just everything you want to understand is physical. The invisible stuff doesn't offer anything relevant to you, period. Okay, so you keep your eye on the physical things.
Keep your eye on the ball, as it were.
Exactly. And so the issue about that, Darwin suggested that the traits, that control, that's that real big word, okay, the character of the offspring are passed from the parents to the offspring. Well, if they're passed from parent to offspring in a physical, mechanical, material world, then whatever controls the traits must be carried by the sperm and egg and then manifest themselves physically in the offspring. Then everybody agreed way back then, real early, like, okay, traits are controlled by physical things. They didn't know what they were because everything was physical, so you, first thing, you don't even suggest invisible. Traits are controlled by physical things that are passed through the germ cells that can end up and control the offspring. The focus of biology, which was shaped by the physics of the time, which is everything is mechanical, is that, well, the human body is like a giant mechanism, a machine made out of chemical parts and things like that. And then this thing was like, well, if you could identify those physical things that carry the traits and manipulate them, then you can manipulate the traits. Since biology at the time was in that Newtonian belief system, the mission statement of biology, which is, I think, still the same mission statement, is to dominate and control nature.
Right. That sounds really cooperative.
Well, it isn't, because it's, if it's a machine, it's like, well, how you cooperate with the machine? You tell the machine.
Yeah.
So then all of a sudden that perception or perspective says that we tell the machine.
Yeah.
But you can't tell the machine until you understand how you can control the traits of the machine, but now the traits are at least somewhere in those sperm and eggs. So it's like, okay, the direction was already set. The opinion was already produced. The conclusion was physically being sought after that was already focused upon before the experiment.
There wasn't even any actual research done. They just jumped to that conclusion.
They jumped to the conclusion. Sometimes when things seem very obvious, you know, then at some point you just grab for the obvious, only to later find out as a cosmic joke that you missed something.
After they've had it in textbooks in school for how many years and still do?
Well, they still do. The issue really concerns investment into the process.
Well, yeah, and all the spring-offs from that, like the pharmaceutical industry, for example.
And the maintenance of the belief that allows the pharmaceutical company to work goes back to that same principle of the Newtonian physics. It's a machine, it's physical, it's made out of matter. You want to adjust the machine, you adjust it using matter, and matter in this particular case are called drugs. So then all of a sudden they become self-important in the process by establishing that the process only operates the way they say it does.
So you mentioned the word belief there, which is pretty fundamental in everything you're talking about, Bruce. And we're looking at the belief in the pharmaceutical industry, which is based on this falsehood, basically, in how things actually work. And you're looking at a whole new approach to what belief really means and how belief can affect our lives in a much more positive and, shall I say, victimless fashion.
Well, right. The word victim, that's the critical word at this reason. I tell you from the professional point of view, I'm the biomedical person, right? And
okay.
I tell you about you, and I say you are a biochemical machine and you are controlled by genes. And now you see this issue that you have? Well, that's something wrong with the machine. And therefore, we can fix it by either changing your genes or changing the biochemistry. Those are the two things. Until recently, of course, changing the genes was an idea that couldn't really be obtained, so that in lieu of changing genes, you just change the chemical environment to affect the operation of the genes. But that means changing it with chemicals, which means buying a drug and putting it into the system. Now, the problem is that, indeed, physical things are involved. There's no question about that. But if you look at it the way they did, which is the Newtonian perspective, there is only the physical, and then anything other than physical is not worthy of academic consideration. So it says, if I'm a scientist and I look at the body, I look at it physically, and you tell me about mind and energy and fields, and I look at you going, well, that's very nice, but that has no relevance to the body. The body's a physical machine.
Yeah.
So then everything I do from that point on is how I can leverage or influence the physical machine without trying to understand the nature is, are there other mechanisms of control? So I throw out the invisible stuff just because that was a given. That was a starting point that you don't have to invoke visible stuff. That was actually when science separated from religion. And that is the whole focus point, actually, is that religion claimed that everything was controlled by the invisible stuff. And when things seem to be out of control in the world and things go crazy, and then so the people in the black coats were saying, God and spirit did this, and be careful, and all that, a new group of people wearing white coats came in and said, but maybe I can understand it without putting the invisible stuff. Maybe it's possible that it's just a physical thing. And that instead of the religious view of invisible moving forces, which can be defined as spirit, instead of invoking spirits, let's just invoke this as a mechanical machine.
Yeah, but Bruce, there's a bit of a crack in that theory because the science has become the new religion and they put the fear of God in us if we don't go along with their dogma.
Well, now we even step one step even further back because we go now back to the religion point as well. And it goes like this, that in our world, in order for me to make more money than anybody else, I have to provide something that is of value to somebody. When you go back to that ancient, darker world where there was no real science at that point, and phenomena of the planet and weather and people and everything were just such a mystery that you shrouded it, and you bought a belief because it seemed good at the time that there are spirits, that spirits are influencing this unfoldment. Now, here's where the problem comes from. The people who told you that story also added one little caveat. They said, we are the ones who speak to spirit. So now what did they do? Is they put the fear on the outside. They tell you, this fear is going to get you, but guess what? You can't get there
exactly
without me. And so that's how they manipulated the situation. They had everybody live in fear that the unknown was going to get them, but they, as mediators of the unknown, for a certain fee, which was kind of high,
yeah,
would do this interface and take care of it for you. And of course, the problem is, over the time, the church became more of a burden than a support, and that's what led to the Reformation. The Reformation said, get off my back, you know, with this stuff, because the story you've been telling all these years, I haven't gotten any better, I paid a lot of money, and things are worse, so now to explain that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that opened up the opportunity of science to come in. And then science says, okay, let's throw out the spirit stuff. And can we understand it by the mechanical stuff? And then they say, oh, yeah, look, it's these mechanisms and these chemicals, and they interact, and this and this and this and this. All of a sudden they say, we know how it works. You have a broken machine. Do you want it to get it fixed? Then you must come to us. We, wearing the white coats, actually know how to fix the machine, and those guys in the black coats, they just have a story. But so it ends up, whose story did the people buy? At first, they held on to the black coats. But now, over time, the miracles of science outstrip the miracles of the people wearing the black coat. So the white coat people all of a sudden got all the attention and the relevance. Even people who claim to be very religious, if they have a cancer, before they go to the priest, they'll go to the doctor. Oh, stand back. What does that mean? The answer is they may claim religion is very important, but when it comes down to immediate threat on their life, let's go to the mechanical guy. He's the one that's going to do it. And the issue is this. Over time, just as the priests were found to be ineffective in delivering on their belief that they could control the spirits in this process, it didn't work, right?
Right.
Our belief that the people in the white coats were going to do this for us, and we gave them a number of years to do that, and now we're at a reformation point. Because with all the promises, with all the claims, people are sicker now than they've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
The environment's getting sicker than it's ever been. We're facing crises that we've never faced before. And there's a point where you have to look back and say, well, you told me you knew how to take care of this. And all of a sudden people realize if they have a problem now, they're not so anxious maybe to jump into the conventional doctoring field, that people started to recognize that they were getting a more positive effect by complementary sources. And at some point then all of a sudden the crowd started to get a little restless. The Church of the White Coat Scientists get a little upset because now they're realizing that the dollars that they've commanded forever are now going to other places. And so there's a backlash of the science church. You come back into the fold, because what we're going to do is we're going to attack everybody who claims that they can do what we do.
We're going to make illegal the natural healing herbs and plants.
Right, because I can't control them.
Doesn't this go against what they signed up for as doctors, to take care of the patients?
Hippocratic oath. Hypocritically Hippocratic in this regard. The Hippocratic oath, the first premise is do no harm. Then all of a sudden you have to stop, and we face a statistic that is clear. People can look up the statistics on the website Gary Null, GaryNull.com, and there's an article that Gary provides called Death by Medicine, which is the statistics of how many people die of what is called iatrogenic illness. And iatrogenic illness is simply illness that is related to medical treatment, meaning this: I come in with issue A, and I go to the doctor, I got issue A, I need some help. The treatment is then carried out, and you die from problem B. Problem B wasn't the initial problem. Problem B is the result of the treatment. Okay, that's called the iatrogenic illness. The statistics reveal that over 750,000 U.S. citizens die every year from iatrogenic illness. That statistic, as shocking as it is more astonishing when you realize that represents the leading cause of death in the United States.
Wow.
That the second leading cause of death is about 700 million people a year, and that is cardiovascular disease. Medicine is more lethal. Because no one talks about this, because it's not the common fact that they show you on television news, and there are reasons as to why. Simply, most of the broadcasting dollars come from the drug industry anyway. They're not going to, you know, bite the hand that feeds them, so they don't describe this. But I think people should stop. They should be shocked. They should be incensed. They should be outraged that this is a fact, and I'm not making it up, that 750,000 people die from medical treatment, and then they go after a guy selling vitamins and call them quacks and things and stuff like that. And the reality is, my God, they're so offensive about these other things. We have never stopped to look at what they're doing. And it's just like the church was back a long time ago. Church was making all the claims that we're going to help you. Their pressure and the amount of money that they collected and their control over people was the problem more than anything else was a problem. That's what led to the Reformation.
Well, with all of this, both the white coats and the black coats, there's so much fear involved, counterproductive to any kind of healing or growth or productive life.
Right, and all the fear comes from what? The first premise is, I am a victim. It's out of my control. Other things affect me and I can't deal with them, and I need to get the professional between me and the source of the problem.
I need to count on you, but I can't trust you.
Well, that leads to a backlash where people seek other truths. And the interesting thing is this. The science that conventional medicine has predicated its truths by is a science that's based on the physics of Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton physics, Newtonian mechanics, is a physics that emphasizes the physical world, like I mentioned, and ignores as irrelevant the invisible spaces. Well, this was an effect of physics up to a certain point, which was 1925. Because by 1925, there were understandings that completely revolutionized the field of physics. And here's what the difference is. Newtonian physics, a mechanistic material universe, the smallest things in the universe are atoms. Atoms, by their definition, mean uncuttable. That's the smallest thing there is. So the point about it is that then science says, well, if you want to understand the nature of anything, you understand the character of its atoms. These are the physical things that make it up. So your atoms are different than my atoms, and that's why you're different than I am, period. So the differences are accountable in the atoms, which are the molecules, which are the physical things that make up the body. By 1925, a new breed of physicists had come up to find out something that was totally extraordinary. That little marble-like thing called an atom turns out actually not to be so physical as we thought it was, because they found out the atom is made of something else. You can break the atom, and inside there are other things. So it's like, so the new level of physics says, ooh, what are those things inside the atom? Well, the first shock was, they're not physical, not tangible.
Yeah.
They're not particles. They're energy vortices, like little tornadoes. And why is this relevant? Because the first understanding that comes out of this is, number one, what we look at as physical matter at the fundamental level is not matter at all. It's energy. And all of a sudden, why that becomes important, because then they found out that the invisible spaces between the matter is also filled with energy. Then it says the invisible spaces and the energy that makes up matter are interconnected with one another, and that the field, the invisible energy that surrounds us, actually is more responsible for the shape of matter than matter is. But in my lectures, what I show is a slide where I take some iron filings and I sprinkle them on a piece of paper using like a salt shaker. Just put the iron filings.
Yeah.
Salt shaker, sprinkle it on a piece of paper, and you get a random pile of iron filings. And so you throw it away, you sprinkle it again, you get another random pile, and you keep doing it. Every time you do it, you get a random pile of filings. And then once, I say, before I sprinkle it, I stick a magnet underneath the piece of paper. Now I sprinkle the iron filings. Guess what? They don't fall randomly anymore. Now they have the shape of the magnetic field. So, okay, throw it away, sprinkle again. It has the shape of the magnetic field. This little simple demonstration provides the most important understanding that I could talk about in the simplest version. It says this: matter alone, iron filings, don't form any structure. They just are piles of sand. But particles in a field, like the magnetic field, then become organized. And there's a statement by Albert Einstein. I'll say it slowly because it's really important, because if just you understand this one statement and then apply it to life, then everything changes the meaning of life. And it goes like this. Quote, Albert Einstein, "The field is the primary governing agency of the particle." What Einstein was saying was the field, the invisible forces, are the primary governing agency of the particle, matter. The invisible forces shape matter. Relevance? Medicine, focusing on only the tangible physical forces, ignores the invisible stuff. And yet, according to physics, you can't just ignore it. You have to recognize, not just to ignore it, that it itself is more fundamentally important in shaping the matter than anything else was. If medicine throws out the invisible, what do they throw out? The mind. They throw out the energy fields that we live in. They throw out the fact that all matter, as I said, we thought was made out of little particles called atoms. Now, all matter is actually made out of energy vortices. Relevance about that is that anything that's made out of matter also gives off energy. It says, then, when two physical things come next to each other, while we don't see them physically connect, their energies become entangled, the invisible stuff. And since the energies are more powerful in shaping things, the entanglement of energies between two people has a profound effect on the physical character of the people involved.
You can't ignore it.
Well, yeah, but we do in biology, don't we? We don't talk about the mind and the field. They left the mind out as much as they possibly could leave it out because it turned out to be an interference with medicine.
Bruce, I have to ask you, with these kinds of thoughts, you're almost a heretic, aren't you, in your field?
I am a heretic, because science, which was designed to counter religion, the black coats and the white coats, the white coat people have become a religion unto themselves in this regard, because they created a dogma, like a set of Ten Commandments. And this they hold to be the absolute shining star of truth in science.
What is the definition of dogma?
I love this. Let's first go this way.
Okay.
That fundamental truth in science is called, in the science textbook, the central dogma, the fundamental dogma. And the dogma is that the flow of information in biology, which was a belief that was seeded by Darwin, remember we said that traits control it. When they found the traits for the DNA, they created the dogma, and the dogma is DNA controls life. That DNA goes through a sequence of steps. DNA influences what is called RNA, which is like a Xerox copy of DNA. And then the RNA is used to make the proteins of the body, and the proteins give us our shapes, our physical characters, and our behaviors. So I ask, where did your physical shape, characters, and behaviors come from? It comes from the DNA.
Right.
And since the DNA was given God status, because what it meant, if you look at the dogma, nothing influences DNA. DNA influences other things. So the source comes from the DNA, called the central dogma. I taught this. I taught it in medical school. Any elementary school that's surrounding you, it's being taught.
This is incredible.
And what's interesting about this is when I got out of the field by being a heretic, why? Because I challenged the dogma, and I realized that by staying inside that they didn't want me in there because I was like a priest that runs into the Vatican and calls the Pope a phony. I didn't really care to stay there anyway because I realized they were not paying attention. But when I got out of it, that's when I came to finally look up the word dogma because I realized, look, I've been teaching this as fact of science for years. And I thought, dogma is a funny name for it. So I looked up dogma and I was shocked because when I saw the definition of dogma, it was, this is the quote, a definition based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. And I realized, my God, that actually it was a correct assertion about the DNA story.
Mm-hmm.
It was a religious belief because the scientific fact never backed it up. But it was believed since 1859. And it was such a strong belief that the belief existed before the experiments. Even before they knew DNA existed, the belief existed. Found DNA, plugged it into the belief. But the issue was, as we started to find out, that belief is fractured. For the reason is, DNA does not control anything. And yet we bought it because it was inherent in the belief system that traits control life, that the traits are controlled by the DNA. DNA controls life. And then it turns out, but a simple scientific assessment reveals this. This is like, we have to stop and just say, wait a minute, what is DNA? It's a linear blueprint that the DNA is cut up into segments with little blueprints, each segment representing a blueprint to make a protein of the body. It's actually a linear blueprint how to make proteins of the body, and the proteins are the building blocks. Why this is relevant is because we have given DNA its own life. You know, it's like the gene turns on. What does that connote to somebody who says, oh, I had nothing to do with it, but this gene turned on, and then I had cancer. Oh, okay, then you're a victim because the genes did this to you. And so then we go to the doctor as victims, and they try to change the chemistry for the faulty gene. That's the nature of the way it is.
Right.
But then we come back to a simple truth. Wait a minute, what was a gene? No, a gene is a blueprint to make a protein. What I give in my lectures is just a little story that people, it's like, stop and think about this. You go to an architect's office, the architect is working on a blueprint, and you stand behind the architect, and as he's working on it, you casually ask the architect, excuse me, is that blueprint on or off? And then the moment of that silliness dawns on you, the architect looks at you like, oh, what are you talking about? It's neither on and off. It's a blueprint. It has no on or off. It's a blueprint. And the reality is, a DNA gene is a blueprint. It has no on or off. It's a linear story. an assembly diagram of how to make a protein. You could put it on an architect's table and actually draw out the blueprint. And yet, what does the central dogma tell us about biology? It says DNA controls. That means activity. Like, the DNA makes a decision. Like, a DNA or genes are self-actualizing, that they decide things. And all of a sudden, we become victims of their decisions. And the reality is, a blueprint doesn't decide anything. So the new field of biology that is actually officially, I think, formalized maybe 16 years ago, which is interesting because it's still trying to break itself out of the box that the conventional scientists don't want to look at, is this new field is called epigenetic control. And this differs from what we teach in medical school, which is called genetic control.
So what is epigenetic control?
Let's first go back to genetic control. If I say literally, what does genetic control mean? It's a control by genes. That's our belief system. That's what we teach. Your life is not anything to do with you. It's controlled by genes, genetic control. The new science is called epigenetic control. The prefix epi is Latin for above. If I say the word epidermis, that means the layer above the dermis. Well, if I now go back literally and say epigenetic control, what does it literally mean? It says control above the genes. And this is the revolutionary new science, because it turns out, so what is it that controls those genes? When we have been victims of genes, now we're finding out, no, it's not the genes that have caused the problem, it's the control of the genes. And
right.
I say, now what is that? And the answer is this: epigenetic control reveals that biological organisms interact with their environment. And whatever information is provided by the environment, that information is translated by the biology into a behavior of the biology so that it can adjust the biology to stay alive
mm-hmm.
in that ever-changing environment. For example, what controls, let's say, your body temperature? And well, you could go in there and give me a whole physiological thing and go back and say, oh, there's a portion in the brain and it senses and that is the control. And the fact is, no, that is the mechanism of the control. What is the control is the temperature. Walk outside.
The environment.
It's right. If you walk outside and it's cold, then the signal of cold is picked up by the biology, converted into a behavioral response that causes your body temperature to warm up. But if you walk outside and it's warm out, the sensing of warm activates a different pathway, changes the biochemistry, and now you perspire and cool down.
Right.
So the issue was this. I can give you all the brain control mechanisms, what they call the, you know, the centers of the brain that control temperature. But when I say the centers control temperature, it's like, well, they manifest the mechanism of the control. Do they control it? No. What the temperature does is controlled by the prevailing temperature of the environment. If I want to change my temperature in my body, well, there's two ways to do it. I can go outside and feel a different environment, or change the temperature in my house, raise it up or down, and then I can adjust my biology. Or we can do the conventional medical pharmaceutical ideas. It's, oh, you need a control mechanism. I can give you a drug that I can change your temperature. And one of them is like, well, one is a natural control, and the other one is an interference with a machine.
I'm going to just take a little bit of a leap here, Bruce. This is like an ongoing thing for people who've been adopted and don't know their birth parent traits are, right? Like
yeah.
whether they have a propensity to get cancer or breast cancer or heart attack or stroke. And are you saying that none of that is relevant now in our belief system?
This is like a stock phrase. It's a very profoundly important phrase, so listen to it carefully. It comes from Henry Ford, and this is a truth, and it's so beautiful. If you think you can, or you think you can't, you're right.
Exactly.
And basically what it says is this: whether you can or can't is really based on your belief if you can or can't. And if you change your belief to I can, then you can. And if you have a belief that you can't, then you can't. And why is this relevant? Because your ability was in your belief, not in your mechanical ability. It was in your belief. And therefore, whatever you believe is going to become material. Now, here's what the point is. I go into a doctor. I get the belief that I am a victim of genetic heredity, that cancer runs in my family, that my belief, as acquired from the doctor, is that I have the greatest propensity in my life to manifest as cancer because it's genetic, it's in my family. I walk away from that doctor, what is my belief? I am a potential victim waiting for what? The cancer gene to act, okay? And that's my belief system. if I actually believe that, and we understand now the epigenetic control that we talked about, the environmental interpretation, is filtered by the brain. So if the brain perceives the environment and then makes a statement about or belief about that environment, that statement, that belief, is converted into biology. Let's say we're in a warm room, comfortable room, and I hypnotize you. I give you a hypnotic suggestion that it's extremely hot in this room, even if it's not. But your perception now, because it's got a distorted belief, because that's what the hypnosis is, right? I distort the belief. I say it's hot. Your perception is now not reading the real temperature. It's buying what the mind said, because the mind is the interface between the outside temperature and the inside temperature. The mind says, no, it's really, really hot in here, because that's what it believes. The cells of the body, their information comes from the mind. The mind said hot. So the body is going to start to perspire like crazy. And guess what? Temperature out there wasn't hot at all. I love this one. This is another interesting one, because it's like to see how the brain and the body coordinate so that if the brain buys a belief, the body will manifest that belief. I hypnotize you and then tell you that this glass of water on the table weighs 1,000,000 pounds, and I ask you to lift it. Now, the whole idea is this, of course, in any logical sense of the term, of course, it's just a glass of water. I lift it, no problem at all. But if I put in the belief that I believe that glass is 1,000,000 pounds, and I'm hypnotized, when I put my hand around that glass and try to lift it up, you will see me strain, and I could strain so hard, I could challenge my heart that I could probably get a heart attack trying to lift up a glass of water. And you say, well, how can that be? I mean, the glass only weighs that little bit of water. And here's what happens. Because the mind made it 1,000,000 pounds, which means you can't lift it up. That's your belief. I can't lift 1,000,000 pounds. Then the nervous system has already got a program. It says, in regard to this glass of water, you cannot lift it. That's the program. That's the command. Why? It's 1,000,000 pounds. Of course you can't lift it. I put my hands around it. As the muscles could feel that I could actually lift it, then what would it say, a feedback from my body to my mind? My mind says it's 1,000,000 pounds. I put my hand around it and I lift it. And it says, oh, you've lifted 1,000,000 pounds. Okay? Well, the mind says, no, you can't lift 1,000,000 pounds. You know, here's the funny part. The muscles that are going to be lifting up the glass become counteracted upon by the muscles that would be putting down the glass. And so it becomes an isometric exercise. The muscles of lifting are countered by the muscles of putting down.
Wow.
And what's the result? You are struggling. Your muscles are feverishly working, but in opposite directions to each other. And guess what? Can't lift the glass.
Interesting.
And now your mind is satisfied, because if you lift it, it would be a distortion to the mind of, you can't lift 1,000,000 pounds. How did you do that? I love this one. This is a reverse one. So exciting. It was just a recent article in the paper about it, and I got to get the reference because we talk about it, but it came back up again. There was an Oldsmobile that had turned over, and a child was caught under the car, and a woman came out. Of course, she could have gone back in the house and called 911, and there's a baby under the car. No thinking. The mission was, I have to get the baby out from the car. The woman lifted the car and pulled the baby out. It was so exciting. The story goes on. Then when the police got there and everything, they asked her to recount, so what happened? And she said, well, I came out and the baby was under the car and I got all nervous and everything. I had to get the baby. And then said in her own conscious mind, I lifted the car. And then she passed out. She passed out because the mind couldn't even buy that was a reality, that it was such a conflict that she actually, when being asked about it, the mind caused her to pass out because it didn't make any sense anymore. And why is it relevant is that, what powers do we have? Well, we're virtually unlimited in powers except for the powers of belief. And if I believe I can't lift the car, I can't lift the car. Can't heal myself because the professional told me, then even if I have the ability, I will cancel my own healing ability.
It's like when people are going in for chemotherapy and they kind of get, you know, 1 foot over in that camp and then they put another foot over in the complementary treatment camp and they can't really make a commitment either way. I mean, it kind of divides their belief then, doesn't it?
They have no true belief now that they can follow because one belief challenges the other.
Yeah, like the muscles you were just talking about.
That was actually a wonderful, and I was thinking the same thing as you said that. When they challenge each other, there's no place in the middle. That's a big problem.
And there's this quote, I think it's from Jonathan Livingston Seagull, argue for your limitations and sure enough they're yours.
Coming from the conventional world of teaching and being a practitioner in the scientific research of a belief system that claimed genetic dominance and mechanism over anything else, to come to where I am now with the new biology and the new physics, and then reflect back on, my God, people have been saying the same story from the beginning. And it's interesting because I wasn't raised in the Christian tradition, but everything that Jesus said and everything he did was based on the belief of the people he worked with. So we helped somebody get healed. He didn't say, I'm going to heal you. He asked the first question before he would even work with them. He said, do you believe you can be healed? And then you are healed by your faith.
Yeah.
What was the point? Was that it was the belief. He didn't say, I'm healing you. He actually owned what he knew was true. You were healed by your own faith. And then he said, all those things you see me do, you can do them better than I can. But for what reason? Why can't you do them? Because you don't believe. And now the power of belief. Now, and it's fun because this is from the spiritual tradition, but it will make sense to this very minute. And it goes like this. I paraphrase this, not being a Bible scholar or anything like that. And my paraphrase is this. Jesus could not do miracles in his own hometown. He had to leave town. And the reason is what? Because he just lost it, like kryptonite, that now the miracles don't work. It was, in a sense, a kryptonite. What it was the belief of other people. Because he said, everything I do is because of the belief of you. If the other people didn't believe, then he had no power to do a miracle. And they looked at him as like, oh, that's Joe's kid. What the hell is he? But when Joe's kid left somewhere else, he was the Christ. All of a sudden, that had a different meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And other people had this belief, and so when he came in, then encouraged collective belief to create miracles, and miracles were created. If he would go back home, the collective disbelief of the people around him even prevented him from expressing the miracle. Now, stop that long enough and think about it this way. I am a person in a community. The community's belief is conventional medicine. The community's belief is that in order to heal, I need to take these drugs or have this surgical procedure. And I say to myself, but I can overcome this. I can override this. I'm going to do my own miracle. If you heal yourself in the presence of an entire community that says you can't, that would be such a distortion that it's interesting, because in the same thing that Jesus couldn't do the miracle because the people didn't believe, if you are trying to create the miracle in your healing, but you're in a community that has total disbelief about that, then you will end up in the same situation that Jesus was, and that was, I'm sorry, I can't do the miracle because nobody else is here supporting it.
Now, this links into my understanding of what you're talking about, the body being like a community and the subconscious being that disbelieving community. Would that be accurate?
Well, the subconscious is the collective beliefs by which the community adheres, meaning this. Basically, as the book talked about, is that each one of us, although we represent ourselves as a single human body, that singularity is not a real truth, because the body itself is made out of up to like 50 trillion cells. It's the cells that are the units of life. The cells, we are a community of cells. And why is this important is because I didn't say we're a bunch of cells, we're a community of cells.
Right.
Cells used to live alone. As a matter of fact, for the first 3 billion years on this planet, there were only single-celled organisms. They didn't join up and form physical communities. They were just single organisms. Well, when they joined up and started to assemble into colonies, and the colonies got bigger, and then they took on the shape of animals and plants. When they joined these colonies, there had to be an agreement, and the agreement is this. Well, every cell is intelligent. If you join a community, you're joining to share a common vision. And therefore, if you're inside a community, then you have to agree to what's going on in the community, because if you don't, then the community falls apart. So the nature is this. While every cell is intelligent, when it joins the community, it will defer its own personal intelligence and accept the intelligence or the information sent from the top down, the central voice, you know, the spokesperson for the community,
right,
which is represented by the mind, which is connected in a sense to the brain, but not the brain, but connected to the brain. The design of the system was to organize the community and have the brain be the integrator of all the functions. So the brain passes down information from the top of how to integrate everybody to cooperate in this thing. So the brain's perceptions of what's going on by the nature of the community override the perceptions of the individual cells, so that an individual cell in your body may say, well, everything is wonderful and healthy and fine. I don't see anything wrong. And the brain sends down a signal that says,
right,
no, we're under attack, we're under threat. And all of a sudden, so while the individual cell doesn't see any reason to it, guess what? The mechanism from the top said, get into protection. Then the cell adjusts its biology to fit the protection. Now, the problem, of course, is this. Down at the cellular level, I got this communication that I need protection. if the cell was really thinking, it might say, you know, is this really true, or is my government screwed up? And the reality is, because sometimes there are misinterpretations about life.
Sure.
And if there's a misinterpretation, the cells don't have a choice to say, oh, I don't believe that. The cells are part of the community. They have to do what this community says. So I'll give you an example. As I said, when we go out and touch the temperature, the perception of temperature, the signals of the environment, control our own internal responses, okay? Well, think if there's a distortion of the perception. So I use the case of an anorexic. We look at this anorexic and we see this person skinny as a rail, near death, you know. It's like, oh my God, I feel very scared. This person's got no meat on them, you know.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, so we look at the person, we see this total skinny little person, but when that person looks at the mirror of themselves, they perceive a much more bloated individual.
And how can that be?
There's a visual distortion. The visual distortion comes from a belief system that was acquired very early in life.
And is that the subconscious then?
That would be the subconscious.
Okay.
It learns something about its own perception of maybe I'm too big. And some connections now in psychology have connected, in fact, the number of people that are anorexic, when they were in utero in development, there were challenges to the mother and her health. And so the system was, in a sense, trying to eliminate weight to support the mother. So there was a concept of, no, you have too much, you shouldn't have that much. And so when they get older, their mind will look at the world and say, you know, you have too much, you shouldn't have that much. So when it looks at the self in the mirror, it's like, well, it's too much. And so there's a distorted image, but what's the point? Well, the cells in the inside, they don't get to look at the real mirror. They get to look at the interpretation of the mirror through what the mind said. So if the mind said too fat, the cells don't look around at each other and say, Jesus, they're already thinned out here so much. But the information comes down, says too fat, and so the system will try to eliminate more. And the point is, well, how much do you eliminate until you're the right weight? But if the system is distorted, then you could kill yourself before you get to the right weight. Perceptions control biology. But sometimes our perceptions are skewed or inaccurate or basically misperceptions, regardless of whether it's true in the real sense or believed to be true, but it's a misperception. The cells respond to whatever the signal is that came out of the brain. The cells don't see whether it's true or not. They just respond to the signal. So if the brain has a distorted perception, the biology has a distorted biology.
So this puts a lot of responsibility on our thoughts, right? And on ourselves, rather than feeling, as you were saying earlier on, as being victims of that biology. We actually can shape that through how we look at things. And that's not only how we look at things, but being conscious of how we look at things.
Well, exactly, because that was the whole issue. I mean, why is it that a person that is riddled with cancer and counting this person out as dead has a change of belief and says, I'm getting out of this place. I'm not putting up with this. They pull the wires, the plugs, and all of a sudden they realize they don't have the cancer. That's called a spontaneous remission.
Well, it's also called a miracle and an exception.
Well, yeah, but that's the problem because it doesn't fit to any of the mechanical initiatives and directives that have been programmed by the medical people. So if it's outside of the box, they cannot entertain anything other than the information that's inside the box. And inside the box is, this is a biochemical machine controlled by genes. If it was already got cancer, that's a distortion of the machine. It should die. And yet, when some kind of healing occurs, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, we made a misdiagnosis. That's our usual thing. What if I claimed I healed myself? Stop and think about that for a second. You have here the biggest industry on the planet today, the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
And their money controls the advertising, the media, what you see on the television, the news. So their belief systems shape what we perceive, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is this, what if people stepped outside the box all of a sudden and said, I seem to have gotten a lot better without getting medical treatment? Then all of a sudden, the people inside the box are going to get very nervous. And the first thing they're going to claim is, well, that person outside the box is stupid, and they could kill you if you followed them. Don't go there, you know, because the threats are that if you follow them, that is not scientific, because we are scientific. They're outside the box. And therefore, you want to be scientific, then you stay with us. You go outside, and you're in, you know, snake oil land. And the only problem with it is this, is that over time, the threats of staying in the box become more severe than the threats of going outside the box.
Seems to me you've been outside the box for quite a while.
I left the first time in 1980, came back into academia in 1987 after 7 years of devoting into a new understanding, came back and had an opportunity to experiment with these new understandings at Stanford University School of Medicine, published my papers, and then left again in 92 because revealing what I saw the first time in 1980 even with more clarity, and yet the field was so involved in the Human Genome Project that because my results were really looking outside of the box and finding that the genes did not control things, the interior people looked at me like, get out of here, you know, we're the human genome people, and you're trying to say that genes are not that powerful. I didn't fit. I left again because their science eyes were not open. They were closed by dogma. And that meant then the nature of what I perceived as science really now was religion. In this, here I offer scientific experiments that are actually published. I tried to discuss it to them. It appears to be an exception to their way of thinking. And since they're already on a mission for genes, then let's don't go there. And I'm thinking, well, you're not really scientific because if there's an exception, there are no exceptions. I mean, if you have a law, if it's a scientific truth, I have a truth with these exceptions.
Yeah, right.
Well, then you don't have a truth.
No.
Because if the exceptions, that means then your truth doesn't count for everything. So exceptions become an anathema. And for me, they never were, because as a research scientist, I really looked at it the other way around. The exceptions revealed that I didn't understand something, and that by addressing the exceptions, I can enhance my understanding. In this particular case, science had changed, unfortunately, in the last number of years, and I saw it very, very much. The simplest insight of that is when I first was a graduate student, this is the University of Virginia, and then when I was initial faculty member, University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, I could tell you when I walked through the faculty parking lot, you saw old beat-up Chevys and Volkswagens and run-down vehicles and things like that, because we were scientists, man. We didn't make any money, but we were out there for the, you know, the pioneer venture. When I left the industry, and I was at Stanford then, and walked out in the parking lot and walked among all the Beamers and Mercedes and the sports cars and all the money, I realized this thing has changed. People are into biology now not because of the reason I went into it 30, 40 years ago, which was the adventure of a new frontier, Star Trek, you know, going where no other people have gone.
You were gripped by the fascination of it.
And today, people get in the field because that's where the money is. But
yeah.
That just really reveals, well, what was the purpose of coming into science? The purpose is coming in to make money, then you go on the money track and you don't focus on the things that don't make money.
Well, it sounds like you're making a new school for yourself with your new book here, Biology of Belief, and sharing this. You're doing a lot of talks and presentations these days, it sounds like, eh?
Well, that's because the Reformation has begun. People are beginning to say, there's got to be another way because this is not working. The beautiful part about it is that when I first started, I was apparently to myself very much isolated, going, I'm the crazy heretic, burn me at the stake.
The mad scientist.
And yet time has been very good to me, and everything I found back in those years as preliminary pioneering science is now becoming more or less mainstream science.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, you're one of many voices now, and I like your portrayal of it as a Reformation. I think that's totally accurate in what's happening these days. I'd like you to describe more about the cells. I also want to just touch briefly on the conscious parenting aspect of your book.
Yeah.
There's something going on in my mind about the idea of taking responsibility for ourselves. I love your description of how we, right from the word conception, and maybe before that, we download so much that becomes our subconscious programming. Can we not then blame our parents? Do we have to take total responsibility for ourselves?
When you put blame, then that happened to me and they did that. I used to close my lectures how the beliefs are acquired, the perceptions are acquired, and how misperceptions are acquired, and how those perceptions and misperceptions then give shape to our biology and our responses to life. It's just a victim kind of understanding. And yet, when I concluded, if you understand how the science worked, this was my conclusion. Here's what the new science means. And it says, you are personally responsible for everything in your life. Well, it was interesting because Well, I had the audience just gripped by this new exciting science and perception and everything. Right up to the very end, they were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I made that statement. All of a sudden, it's like, no. And it was funny how people can turn on you in a time. And I realized at some point, this is really not a good way to end the seminar. Near the end, after everybody left, this woman came in. She was emotionally sobbing. And her husband with her, a supporter and everything. She said, I can't buy the conclusion that I brought things into my life like this. And I tried to think, well, is there another way to say this and still maintain the truth? And I kept thinking, but this is the truth. Then all of a sudden it hit me and I said this. No, how about this as a conclusion, I said. You are personally responsible for everything in your life. Once you become aware that you are personally responsible for everything in your life.
Okay.
And the moment she actually heard that, she said, okay, I got it. I can accept that. Meaning this, if I never told you that you had personal responsibility, I never programmed you, never gave you that information, and then reprogrammed you in ways that I wanted, and then your life lived that way, even though I know now from my scientific point of view you are personally responsible, you didn't have any insight. As a matter of fact, anytime you really started going toward personal responsibility, there was a tendency of your family or the system to take that back away from you again. Who do you think you are, young man?
You know, yeah.
Okay, there's your limiting factor right there, you know. Okay, if where I'm standing today, what does it mean? It says, okay, I look back at my life, I say, wow, the first 40-some years, that was, filled with a lot of horrible, scary, you know, I don't want to go back there ever again situation. But now when I realized, yeah, but I was also participant in those situations, but I was unaware of that. But now here's the point. Where I am now is, but wait, I do understand that I'm involved. And if I am involved and I know I'm involved, then what I can do is say, okay, the past was a learning period, and the current starts now. And the current says, let go of the past, because if you didn't understand how it operated, and nobody did, there's nobody to blame. It's an experience, it's a history, and all that I need to carry forward is some of the information I acquired, but I don't have to do all the behaviors and responses that I did before. So I can let go.
And what you're saying, Bruce, is exactly something I think that works really powerfully, because your belief is so strong. And if you say, that's the story of my life, or I'll never change, or that's always the way it's been, then there you are. But if you say, up until this point, I have believed this, but today I believe something else, then your mind can go with that, right? Because there's a distinction between then and now.
That's it, because remember, the nature of how cells work, and so now we can put this...
Okay, let's go into cells.
The cells respond to the environment, meaning how do they do that? Well, they see the environment. What's going on chemically or inside the body? What are the hormones and chemicals that are passing by? The cell is like, in a reality, a miniature human in its own world. 50 trillion citizen community called the body. There are 50 trillion little people doing jobs, and they're getting information from the government with the form of the chemicals being sent down from the top, telling them what to do.
Yeah.
And so they read the information and adjust their biology to the information that comes from the environment. By definition, as I describe in the book, the process of reading an environmental signal and then turning it into a biological behavior is a process involving perception, by definition. And so why is this relevant? Cells perceive the environment and adjust their biology to what they perceive. Well, cells in a community don't directly perceive the environment, because in the community they allocated a group of cells and said, look, you guys become heart, you guys become stomach, take care of digestion, you guys become lung, you take care of respiration, and you guys, the central nervous system, your job is to do what? Read the environment, tell me what's going on, consider all the implications, and then send down the integrated coordination that how we're going to respond. So the cells say, I read the environment, but I only read the local environment. I get the information about the big environment from the brain. So the brain of the human is like the brain of the cell that was reading the environment, except the human brain reads it for 50 trillion cells. So the human brain reads perceptions of the world. And so it looks at the stimuli, tries to interpret what they mean, and then adjusts the biology to make a response that will keep the biology alive. So we talked about go outside and it's cold out. To stay alive, you have to raise the body temperature. So your perception of cold activates your metabolic activity. Now the issue is okay, so the human and the cell are the same as living organisms. They adjust their biology in regard to what the environmental signals are, and the process of the environment being translated into biology is perception. Okay?
Yep.
So it's how I perceive the world that controls not just my behavior, but my genes. That's epigenetic control. And then the significance says, yeah, but as we mentioned before, sometimes my perceptions are right and sometimes my perceptions are wrong. Regardless of they're right or wrong, the cells are still going to respond to the perception. That's mm-hmm. the Henry Ford statement. If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Whatever the perception is, that's what it is. Okay, now we go back and say, okay, now built into the human biology then is the concept of a mind. The function of the mind is to gather all this information that's coming in, interpret it, and then send a signal back into the body. Well, the interesting thing is we have two minds, one called the conscious mind,
yes.
and one called the subconscious mind, and the difference between them are profound in this regard. The subconscious mind is the equivalent of an autopilot. It reads the environmental situations and adjusts the biology without us even thinking about it. So when you go outside, you don't have to think, is it cold or is it hot? The subconscious mind read the temperature and adjusted it for you automatically. The subconscious mind does automatic programming. The subconscious mind doesn't just read physical things, but it also reads social and community interactions as perceptions of the world, too. It has to learn them, because I can give you a genetic perception of, let's say, calcium. The cell will read the calcium in the environment without learning about calcium. It's programmed that with a perception for calcium. The calcium shows up. It has a device to read it, and so it's built in. But when you get to higher levels of organization, then it's not just things like calcium and adrenaline and estrogen that are signals. It also is, hey, what's going on in your neighborhood? You know, what's your family doing? These are environmental influences that affect your life.
Sure.
So what we now know is this, that the two minds exist. The conscious mind is more or less a mind that's connected with our personal identity, and I would go as far as to say our spirit, okay, that mm-hmm. are as personal individuals. The conscious mind's the thinking, creative mind. But the subconscious mind is a simple record playback. It just records and plays back. It learns from a habit and then plays it back without thinking about it again. And so an interesting thing that we now know is this. In order for us to get off the ground as humans in our community, we have to get fundamental rules to participate. We have to learn the language. We have to learn the rules of I'm the dad and you're the baby. Okay, let's get that hierarchy
yeah, right.
straightened out. This is the policeman, and the policeman is very important because if he says stop, you stop. This is your friend Billy. If he says stop, you can go on or not. That's not the same. Policeman says stop. So we learn every little rule. And what we now know is that the two minds are involved in learning the rule, but the conscious mind doesn't participate early in the game. As a matter of fact, we now have information that the conscious mind really starts to engage in a sense of our creative character to ourselves after we're 6 years of age. First 6 years of age, the dedication of the mind is to download all the rules of society and family and community.
And boy, do we do that well.
We're designed to do that. That's an instinct. When a baby is born, the first thing it will do is look into its mother and father's face and stare at it. And the reason why is a genetic program. It says it learns to distinguish a happy face from a scared or angry face right mm-hmm. away. Because if you have a baby or if you've been around babies, what you'll watch them do is if they're crawling around and they bump into something new that's mm-hmm. not in their database and they've never experienced, they have an automatic instinctual response to look back at the parent's face. What they do is when they look back at the parent's face, they get the interpretation of the parent is of the thing that they're just encountering. Is this good or bad? And the baby will immediately connect the whatever this thing is I just bumped into. This is good for me or not good for me based on what my parents say. So the immediate learning isn't like a child, a baby doesn't have any inherent conscious ability to make a decision. So the mind doesn't allow it to. It just says, look at this code and this will tell you what to do. So our beginning period of life is directly tied in to our parents' perception of life because they're the teachers and the mind of the child is programmed not to be self-creative, but is to download these important messages right away. Some of the programs that are naturally built into the system, we call them instincts. They don't need programming. They're already there. People demonstrate every day. A woman could be in a tub of water, and the baby come out of the birth canal, and by itself will come up to the surface of the water, and then turn on its back, take a breath of air, and then turn back around and go down under the water. And the behavior is almost like a dolphin.
Wow.
And it can do this instinctually. All mammals can swim. You take any mammal, a cat, a dog, a horse, never been in the water before, throw it in the water, it will automatically swim. All mammals can swim. But then comes this funny question, and it's sort of like, well, Johnny might be able to swim when he's born, then why do we have so much trouble teaching Johnny how to swim when he's 5 years old?
Yeah.
What happened between birth and 5 years old in regard to Johnny and swimming? And the answer goes like this. When Johnny was an infant, every time he got near water, the response from his parents, remember, look back at his parents' faces, they would be in fear. And in fact, if Johnny was near the water and nobody was paying attention and the parents saw that, they'd scream, Johnny's down by the brook or the river, the pool, the ocean, to go save Johnny from the water. Well, Johnny's not a stupid child. He's downloading. And what he does, every time he confronts what he sees as water, he gets a signal from his parents. And the signal says, this is dangerous, it will threaten your life. So what happens is, for the first 4 years, he has repetitive habitual learning that every time he gets near water, that water is a threat to his life and his parents freak out. So now Johnny's 5 years old, and now the parents deem it's time for Johnny to learn how to swim. And so they put a bathing suit on Johnny, and what's their first effort? To throw Johnny into the water. And Johnny is screaming his bloody head off, and the reason is why? Well, you've just taught him 4 years in a row that water is going to kill him. In his young mind, what do you think is the meaning of the behavior of throwing him into the water? And the answer is you want to kill him. And guess what? The fear is so overwhelming that even the instinctual ability to learn how to swim is forgotten at that moment.
It's just frozen, yeah.
Frozen. And the reality is that if Johnny were actually allowed to swim from day one, Johnny would not only be healthier and smarter, but he would have a much longer life than if Johnny didn't swim. So all those fears that we put in about the water have actually interfered with an ability for a great exercise for newborn babies in this regard. Because our conventional exercise for newborn babies, well, you put them in a bassinet or the crib or whatever they call those things, and you wait for the developmental stage one, the baby turned itself over. How long did that take? Why can't the baby have moved earlier? And the answer is, when the baby's born, it hasn't exercised any of its muscles. It's not even coordinating them. And it turns out that, as you know, if I'm not an athlete but I exercise, I become an athlete. When a baby is put into water, the instinctual ability to swim is a natural exercise regimen. And because the muscles are so weak, it's like the equivalent of hydrotherapy. You get a patient in a hospital that's been in bed for months, and you want this person to go home now. You don't just say, put your clothes on, get out of bed,
no.
Go home. They collapse. Their muscle strength is gone. So what do? They put them in a swimming pool because the water is buoyant. Holds them up. They can use a lot less activity and still move.
Work with the resistance of the water and
right.
Build them up.
So
yeah.
When a baby is put into water after it's born, it has the opportunity and ability to exercise itself, strengthen the muscles, while the other baby who is just laying in the crib sits there until frustration gets it to do isometric exercises, that is, push itself over. And that takes a long time and a lot of frustration on the part of the baby as compared to a baby who swims. Because in this development of the swimming,
mm-hmm.
It enhances the cardiovascular system. And enhancing that, it also provides more cardiovascular development to the brain, and the brain develops better than it does in a child that doesn't do the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You get more powerful children exercising an innate instinct of already knowing how to swim.
I'm trying to figure out the relationship between the conscious and subconscious mind, that expression, pushing his buttons.
Yeah.
Part of what you say is we're really, really dominated a lot by that subconscious programming, and yet no one's there, and yet the conscious mind seems to want to avoid it.
Yeah, but how come it doesn't?
Yeah.
Okay, now we go back to what we talked about. The subconscious mind is a downloading device.
Yep.
It downloads behaviors and responses to the environment. A little scary piece of this data, that it actually started downloading while we were in the fetal stage of life. What's interesting about it is, well, what kind of information was it downloading then? The emotional behavior of the mother. The mother was happy, then the baby was bathed in a happy environment. The mother lives in fear or threat or concern about the survival of herself or her child. That information is passed on as stress hormones, which the child also reads. So the child is now growing up in a milieu of stress. And these stress hormones are programming the baby even before it's born. And here's a scary one, that when a child wasn't expected and the conception was, you know, not in plan,
right.
Anything like that, and there's like, oh my God, how can we afford this child? This child's going to interfere with our lives and all that stuff. Well, this is a conversation between the parents. They don't recognize that the hormones that give the sensation of rejection are bathing the fetus at this time as well, and that the fetus is also learning rejection even before it's born. Teaching didn't start just when the baby was born. Teaching
No.
started about midway through pregnancy when the nervous system was capable of downloading recurring patterns and experiences. A lot of us were pre-programmed, and people adopt an orphan think, it was just a newborn baby I adopted, it's like a clean slate, and I'm going to help this baby, and guess what? With all the things I tried to do, the baby grew up and became a troublemaker and all kinds of things like that. And they're trying to reflect on, but I provided everything. And it turns out, well, that was really nice, except you didn't realize that the baby already had a program rejection before it got to you, and that was already built into the behavior. So the baby didn't come as a blank slate. It already came with programs. All of us did. So we got a lot of these programs, and the first 5 years is observe the world, observe how our parents respond to and the stimuli in their lives. So we learn by observing them what the stimuli are and what the responses to the stimuli are, and this goes into our subconscious mind. So as we grow up, many of the stimuli in our environment that we encounter, these were stimuli that our parents dealt with, then we will automatically engage in the same behavior that our parents dealt with and dealing with that because that's what we learned, okay? Well, here's the point. You said there are two minds. Yes, after six, the conscious mind starts to arise, and that's the one that has the self-identity and it's self-reflective. And it's the ability of the subconscious mind, the first one, which is, in fact, physically a million times more powerful than the conscious mind. The subconscious mind learned programs, and as you mentioned, you know, the push my button.
Yeah.
The subconscious mind is tantamount to like a jukebox. You push the button, it's going to play the program. Well, if you got the program when you were born in the first year of your life, guess what? You're now 50 years old, you push the same stimulus, you're going to play the same program just as if it just happened again the first time anyway. And the point is, the subconscious mind is a downloader of experiences, which are programs, and connects them to the stimuli, so if the stimuli ever show up, you automatically push the button and the program is pre-recorded, it will play automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It's very convenient because, for example, we'll go over something that we deal with every day, walking. We had to learn how to walk. That was a very difficult process at the beginning of learning how to stand up, stay in balance, and move with momentum and not fall over. We don't think about it. At the neurological level, this is a feat of amazing technology, dealing with thousands and thousands of muscles and nerves interacting and keeping each other dynamically engaged as little changes in pressure and momentum. We can stay in balance. The point is this. If you had to use your conscious mind to walk, A, you spend most of your day trying to move.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be any other thing to focus on because it would require consistent, focused, conscious attention of trying to deal with thousands of muscles at the same time. But the subconscious mind can download the pattern. And if it does that, then my conscious mind doesn't have to think about walking. In fact, it never does. Thinking about going over there, I don't have to first put the command in the system, now walk, right leg, left leg, right leg. I don't have to do that. My intention is to walk. My subconscious mind says, oh, okay, I have the program. You don't have to think about it. On the way over, while you're walking, think about your vacation next.
Yeah.
So the subconscious mind's function is to do routine tasks, repeatable things, and to do them without engaging the conscious mind. So as I use in the book as well, the example of driving a car. When you first got your driver permit, there was no program in your subconscious how to drive a car, so you drove with your conscious mind. You were alert. You watched everything. Now that you've been driving the car for 10 or 15 years, you can put the key in the ignition, start to drive down the street, have a passenger in the car, get involved in a conversation, and then sometime look out the window and it dawns on you that you haven't paid attention for 10 minutes. So the first question is, well, if you weren't paying attention, who was driving the car? And
yeah.
I tell you the subconscious mind, and then here's why it's not scary. Subconscious mind is a million times more capable of observing and to responding to everything faster than your conscious mind ever could. Matter of fact, if you're driving a car and you're about like sliding or getting into an accident, your conscious mind gets shut off and you operate from your subconscious mind. It's much more effective, faster. So while you might say, oh, geez, I didn't pay attention to the road, at least I feel in one regard, well, a more powerful mind was actually driving anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not so bad. This is the big issue. This is the take-home lesson here.
Okay.
The take-home lesson is this. You just drove 10 minutes. You were in conversation. Your conscious mind was involved in conversation and you drove for 10 minutes and I say, describe your driving behavior during that 10 minutes. And then you look at me and go, well, I didn't see it. I was involved in a discussion.
Yeah, right.
And then I said, yes, this is the point. The conscious mind and the subconscious mind have a working relationship. The conscious mind can regulate any part of our biology in our life. If you want to change your blood pressure, you can do it with your conscious mind. You want to change your heartbeat? You can do that with your conscious mind. You can focus on it. Yogis get into that meditative state and then can regulate any aspect of the biology. The conscious mind is a relatively small processor. It can't handle too many different tasks. And so the function of the conscious-subconscious relationship is this. The subconscious mind will carry out every task that's ever been learned without the requirement that the conscious mind pay attention. So I can drive the car and have a conversation. And so here's the trade-off. If the conscious mind can't focus on something, the subconscious mind will automatically do whatever it is. So let's say you do a job, a routine kind of job. You could be doing the routine kind of job and then be thinking about your vacation. And yet the job is being done. It's just like driving the car. If it's automatic, it will automatically do it. But the fact is this, when it does, it will always automatically do it exactly the same way, because you push the button, it's going to play the same thing over and over. Here's this issue. It says that, here's the relationship. Conscious mind is very creative mind. The subconscious mind is a total habitual mind. It plays habit. That's all it does. The creative mind is smaller and can't focus on everything of our lives. So whatever the conscious mind is not focusing on, something that needs to be done, like driving the car, the conscious mind does it. But then here's the trade-off and the catch. Because the conscious mind was busy, that's why the subconscious mind was operating. Yeah, but because the conscious mind was busy, then by that nature, it wasn't paying attention. So what it says is this. When the subconscious mind is carrying out its behaviors, we rarely observe them because it's carrying out the behaviors because we're busy doing something else. Let's say you know somebody, and you know their parent, and you observe that this person and their parent have the same kind of behaviors. And then you say to your friend, Mary, you know, you're just like your mom.
Yeah.
And then you realize that that's not greeted all. It's like, oh, thank you so much for that. It's like, usually it's shock. Like, how can you say that?
I'm an individual.
Yes, right? Is that the conventional response? Now, this is the lesson for the listener. If I see that Mary and her mother share the same behavior, how come Mary doesn't?
Yeah.
And the answer is because her mother's behavior was programmed into her before she was conscious. It's in the subconscious. It plays automatically when? When she's not paying attention. So that when she does behave like her mother, she doesn't see it because her conscious mind's not observing it.
Oh, man.
Take that and you add this one last piece and then you see where, and this last piece is this. Neuroscientists have now revealed that on a day-by-day basis, 95% of our behavior comes from the subconscious mind. And why is that relevant? Well, if we don't observe it, then it says 95% of our behavior is not even observed by us. It's automatic. And yet the issue is this, but whose behavior is it? Go back and realize that the fundamental behaviors of how to deal with life were downloaded before you were six and were programmed by the people in your environment. And so the programs that you are operating 95% of the day are not your programs. They're programs of the way other people responded.
And how they responded to the people they were downloading from.
Exactly. So that your parents learned their behavior from their parents, who learned it from their parents. And the issue is this, then most of us are operating on a day-to-day basis with a programming database of programs that we were not involved with when they were downloaded. We don't even critically watch them because we don't see them when they play, and yet they control our lives.
I don't know what you think about the idea that we choose our parents before we were born. Suddenly that concept has gotten a lot more complicated.
It doesn't, because this analogy plays very well with, I think, the direction of where we're going. And that is, in today's video games that kids play,
right,
they're role-playing games, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when they get into the game, they select a character. But in the selection of a character, then they get a choice of traits. The early ones were like a war game. So I'm a soldier. I'm going to jump into this game, and I'm going to be a soldier. But it says before you jump into the game, well, here's your choice. You could have 5 rockets and 6 hand grenades and 2 machine guns. No. You can change that. You can have 10 rockets, but you have to give up the machine guns. Or, no, if you get more grenades, you can get less rockets and more machine guns. You know, you pick the traits, right?
Right.
So that now you pick the traits, then when you push go, you jump into the game, and guess what? Your character plays the game with the traits that you provided with it, and what's your point is to win the game. And so what you have to do is manipulate the traits that you selected to play them in the game and win the game. I see us coming in, picking the genetic traits and the family to learn the program. And even before we start to play, because we didn't play till we're 6, really, that when we jump in by 6, we've already have the traits, and the nature of the game is now that we're in the body and playing the game from the inside, we forgot that we were outside, that we were like the people, you know, if it was a computer game, that were pushing the buttons on the computer, we become the character on the screen. And the nature of the game is to win the game is to take the traits you came with and beat the system. Or to take the traits you came with and learn the fact that you aren't the traits, but you're the person outside the game.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then you become powerful.
Well, yeah, because I found in my own life and relationships is that I recognize that programming and I see where my buttons are pushed and I see how I go into automatic responses that don't serve me and don't serve other people. And I've seen how I can make choices where it's almost like going against the force of gravity or swimming up a current. I go, okay, this is how I normally would have reacted to this, but now I'm just going to play with this. I'm going to react in a totally different way. So it becomes a playfulness, an experiment,
well,
right?
But see, that's where your power comes in.
Yeah.
Your power is in your conscious mind. We've gone on a track here, and I really need to correct this. This is a very important point.
Okay.
The subconscious mind is neither good nor bad. It's a playback device. The quality of its function is related to the programs that are put into it. Meaning, if I only got negative, bad, crappy, disempowering programs every time I operate my subconscious mind, I'm defeating myself.
Okay? Right.
Think about this as just a possibility.
Okay.
That you were a child, came into a family where the parents were so in love with each other and the community and the people and the planet. Everything they did was on a win-win basis, and everything was like agape love, and they treated everybody this way, and they loved intelligence and all these, I mean, very nice, wonderful things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were the child in that family, your subconscious would have every one of these valuable programs built into it. What's the relevance is that a child from this family can grow up and essentially be unconscious their whole life and be at the top of the pile. Because when they're being unconscious, every program that is running automatically is a program of success.
Right.
And then I say, yeah, how many people do I know like that? And the answer is, well, I can't count them on one hand because they're too few. And that is because we came from parents who were trained by their parents. And the biggest training we got in this planet is disempowerment. Who do you think you are? And then they start to even tell us as kids, you don't deserve that. When parents say things like this to kids, and the child is less than six, that's a program in the subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now what do I have? A program that I do not deserve. Why is that relevant? Well, we talked about when the brain functions, the outcome has to be coherent with what the program is. So if I went out and became highly successful and my program said I don't deserve things, that would be a conflict. So guess what? When I'm going out there and I'm not paying attention, my I do not deserve program will undermine me, sabotage me, and limit me. Why? So that the result comes out to reveal the truth of the statement. Look, I do not deserve. And guess what? I didn't. Like, well, now you're coherent. That's your automatic programming. But then, as you said, your conscious mind sometime wakes up and actually looks at itself and says, my God, this behavior is actually sabotaging me. And then the conscious mind says, well, and today, well, I'm aware of it. Rather than I've done every other day,
yes.
I decide to do this. That's called creative. That's what the conscious mind is. But now here comes the problem. Just because your conscious mind decided on Monday that it would move in a different direction, on Tuesday, if your mind is busy, guess what? You automatically go back to the tape, and the tape still has your original programming. Just because your conscious mind becomes aware of a negative program, it in no way changes the program. They're two separate minds.
Right.
And so you go to cognitive psychology, therapist, right? And you say, yeah, look, when you grew up, your father did this to you, your mother did this, these people did that. And you go through and you go, hey, you live every one of these things. You go, oh, God, yeah, I remember. Oh, that hurt. I wanted to die. And you go through every experience. You relived them again, right? But now they're conscious to you because when you learn them, you may have been unconscious. But now they're conscious and you go and you just said, yep, I understand exactly why I'm in the problematic place that I am today. I understand. And guess what? The person who still gets all this understanding still is in the problematic place and will be. For the reason is this, just because you became aware of it in your conscious mind, that in no way directly means that you rewrote the original program. The original program is the original program. It's going to stay in there until you make an active process to change it. Because if it didn't, just think of this, every day you change your mind, every day then your behavior would change from one day to the next day, the next day, the next day. That wouldn't be a very good thing. You want to make consistency, so subconscious is consistent, but if it's programmed bad, it will be consistently bad. So the design of the system isn't just a change every day. Oh, I tried this today, and now I got a new. So it says this, It allows the separation of conscious and subconscious into separate domains, allows the consciousness to be aware, but doesn't take any awareness that just pops into consciousness and automatically put it into subconscious.
Okay.
That would be very disruptive. Just because I realize I've done bad behaviors, I still have the bad behaviors, what do I do now? Then the process says, yeah, you can rewrite the program, but you make an effort to rewrite the program. Not that I just had a new idea, suddenly I rewrote the program, because then every new idea would erase an existing program and start another one. So it says there's a process by which you now take your awareness, your new understanding, and then try to rewrite the program. It's not just, I saw a new understanding and the program automatically rewrote. It doesn't work that way. And that's the failure of generally the kinds of therapy where I can be very successful in finding out what caused the problems, but in spite of now knowing that, I still have the problem.
And this is talking really about going to the cellular level?
Well, it's going back into a mechanism of working with the nervous system that opens up the doorway, or if talk about the subconscious mind as a recording device,
right?
How to push the record button, take the data that I have and actually record a new behavior. It wasn't the intention of the book to be a self-help book, and because I even just got another email this morning from somebody who said, well, I really love the book and everything, but I was really let down at the end of the thing. Was that wasn't my intention. My intention, it's a science book, and I leave that open because there are a variety of different ways to get down there, and individually, for individual people, you know, one form may work better, another form. It's not for me to do that, and it's unfortunate because people now expect that I must do this, and it's like, but that's not my job. People say, well, Bruce, at least give me some directions. So I'll say, here are three different directions.
Okay.
Number one, processes that are like what my people might refer to as Buddhist mindfulness, which basically says, rather than allowing your mind to keep leaving the current moment and think about the future or dwell on the past, practices of mindfulness say, no, keep your conscious mind right here, right now. Because if you're watching it right here, right now, then you're in the moment of now, and you have those decisions that say all the time, I could do this or that. The consciousness is running the show in the moment of now. And yet, when does the subconscious run it? When your consciousness is focusing on the future or the past or thinking on something like solving an equation, then it's not paying attention to the now. By that definition, the subconscious works. So the more now you can be in, then the more power you have. Number two, clinical hypnotherapy. In a sense that this modality is the closest in the sense of how you actually got the original programs in the first place. Your conscious mind wasn't really working. You were working at lower levels of EEG, which were like a hypnagogic trance, meaning you observe it, you download it. If you go back to a clinical hypnotherapist, you can get your mind back into that same state, and that opens up the recording session so you can record something different.
Okay.
And then thirdly is a large variety of new modalities that are collectively under the title of energy psychology. I'll throw out a few names, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Body talk, avatar, holographic repatterning, EMDR, EFT, Psych-K. There's a bunch. You can Google energy psychology. Some, I think, are better than others in regard to how the modalities is brought to play. But that's for people to figure out. That's not my decision. And what do they all have in common is that they basically provide for a state of super learning. And super learning is an ability to open up that subconscious and download, boom, new data into the subconscious as well as the conscious at the same time. And therefore, it's like pushing the record button on the machine, and you can do in a matter of minutes. You can rewrite programs that have hobbled you your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
You can get them back and change, rewrite a program 5-10 minutes.
Hmm.
So these are the effective modalities of interacting with that subconscious mind and trying to reprogram it to be your friend rather than the invisible device that sabotages you. And that is basically what the resolution of this whole thing is.
We haven't even got to a lot of stuff, like the brain on the membrane of the cell, for God's sake, and our skin being like a brain. Like, do you want to just talk briefly about that?
It's basically, we talked about the concept of perception, and how does an environmental signal, such as, let's say, in our physical body, cold on the outside, or a scary thing like a mountain lion chasing you, how does that information interact with the biology? And the answer is very simple. It's through a structure we call the brain. the brain has organelles called receptors. By the nature, receptor means receiver, receiver of information. So I have eyes, they receive light, ears, sound, taste, and touch, and smell, and pressure, and pain, and temperature. These are receptors out of our system that feed the information from the environment into the brain. The brain makes an interpretation of the information and then engages a biological response. When studying cell biology and recognizing that cells are little individual entities, almost like little humans unto themselves, is that every cell has a brain. Every cell responds to the environment that it lives in and adjusts its genetics and biology to fit. What the book really emphasizes is at some point is that the brain is not the genes, which is conventional thinking. And the reason suggesting that, number one, is that if you remove the genes from a cell, the cell still has a life. It's still integrated, coordinated, its behavior, it keeps it alive and all that, which infers that something is organizing the behavior and coordinating it. And the structure that organizes and coordinates behavior is called the brain, and the genes are not there. It says something else is doing it.
Yeah.
My research led to the reality that it was the membrane or the equivalent of the skin of the cell. And it makes perfect sense as to why this structure would be the equivalent of the brain, because on one side of the skin is the outside world and the other side of the skin is the inside world. Can read two environments at the same time and facilitate an exchange of information. So the skin of the cell, the membrane, becomes the brain of the cell. And then when I relate it to the human, it reveals that if you understand the nature of human embryology, that the central nervous system, the brain, the spinal cord, are derived from the skin of the back.
Right.
That originally is on the outer surface of the embryo, but later folds inwards and forms this tube structure that runs from one end to the other end and becomes the nervous system. So there are nervous system of the human derived from the skin, still connected to the skin anyway, and we have receptors to read the environment all over our skin. And the cell has exactly the same thing. But where we have an eye, which is a very complex, large structure comprised of millions and millions of cells, the cell has an eye, but it's just a little protein antenna with a tuning fork that responds to the frequency of light. So it's simplified version, but same effect. So that the human and the cell, the skin and the brain are the interface between the real world on the outside and the interior world on the inside, and that the brain's function is to read the environmental circumstances and then, based on experiences and instincts, adjust the response of the system so that whatever response it is, it's the response that will tend to keep the system alive. But then, of course, in the human brain, then we develop a large amount of interpretations. And these interpretations, which then become the perceptions, control our biology. But as we mentioned, sometimes in acquiring these interpretations or perceptions, they're actually inappropriate and incorrect. And if they are, then it says every time that stimulus comes up, when we play that behavior, by the nature of it, it was inappropriate or ineffectual or destructive, in fact, a behavior to play in this time and circumstance. So our misperceptions can cause our problems in that regard. And they're reflected by the fact that this membrane skin, its function, when it develops something as large as a human, it can then dedicate trillion cells into just reading the outside environment, that this specialization of cells, this community, becomes that central voice whose dedicated function is read the environment, interpret it, and then coordinate the 50 trillion cells.
It's a lot going on, and it's amazing that people think they can be bored at any moment.
Well, what happened to me when I started to recognize that most of my life was being programmed by beliefs that I acquired from other people, perceptions acquired from other people, that when I learned that, then I realized, I said, well, first of all, my perceptions control my biology and I have power over my perceptions. That's when you talked about, like, what if my conscious mind observes this and decides not to play the same game? And the answer is, well, now you are powerful. You decide, it's up to you. You can play something different. So all of a sudden, what did you realize? You were personally controlling your life. Yet until you become aware of the fact that the fundamental programs in the subconscious, which operate 95% of the day or more, the fundamental ones were programmed by other people. So when I'm running my life, I'm exercising behaviors that weren't maybe in my benefit at all. Matter of fact, most of them are not. And the relevance about that was then, by understanding this and rewriting the behavior, then I became more the powerful influence in unfolding my life rather than letting my subconscious do it with these other programs. And the significance is once I started to reprogram that, I reprogrammed myself for, well, why should I live in fear and pain and have illnesses and all that when I know my biology is very powerful? I program myself to exercise my powers.
And to be successful.
And to be successful, because as all of us have, we've got programs of disempowering ourselves, and that's a way the community works, because by disempowering ourselves, we don't have to have people above us disempower us. And we are programmed that way, and
yeah.
It was program acquired from people who wanted power over us. Here's a fact. The Jesuits are very proud when they say, you give us a child till it's 6 or 7, it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. What did they have an awareness of? Why 6 or 7? What was the meaning of all that? And here's what they knew, that the fundamental programs that control our lives are programmed in the first 6 years. And whatever programs those are, no matter how old I get, if I automatically go to the program, I'm going to go back to that program before 6. So what they did, they said, if I give you the principles of the church before 6, of how it operates, I don't care how old you get, when you're not paying attention, you immediately kick back and work the programs that I gave you. And most of these are disempowering programs, because the effort is, how did they become powerful versus us? The guy is a priest or a scientist, one wearing the black coat, one wearing the white coat. To me, as the pedestrian on the street, these are the more powerful people. One's talking with God, the other one's talking with science. You know,
mm-hmm.
What do I know? I'm a guy, I'm a mechanic. I fix cars. What the heck do I know? So the idea is, I say, oh, well, if I really want to be connected with God, then I'm going to pay the guy in the black thing. And if I really want my health back, I'm going to pay the guy in the white coat. Why am I paying them? Because they're offering me services. What services are they offering? Well, the first one is helping me connect with God, and the second one is helping me connect with my health. And guess what? When you go back and understand the true nature of the biology, you were never disconnected from God in the first place. You and God are always connected in this, because you're connected to the environment, and in the environment, all that is in a sense what some people would call God. You can't be disconnected from the environment. You were created in the image of the environment. It's another biblical statement. And the point about it was this: then you mean I was always connected with God? Then why am I paying this guy? He led you to believe you're not connected with God, and that here's where you're going to go because you're not connected with God. And we bought the belief, and guess what? We terrorize ourselves with this belief. Is it true? No, we bought it. Now, how about the guy in the white coat? Well, he tells me he can heal me. But it turns out they're becoming the leading cause of death, number one. And number two, guess what the biology reveals? You were innately capable of healing yourself from the beginning. That people lived on this planet 1 million years before they had medical schools. And they healed themselves. And the issue was, we are very powerful to heal ourselves, except what? Our perceptual system overrides the biology systems, including the immune system. That's what's called psychoneuroimmunology.
Back to the beginning.
Back
here we go.
So what does it say? It says, if I believe I cannot heal myself, even if I'm capable of healing myself, my belief will shut down my healing and I will manifest the illness. We bought the belief that we're frail, that we're victims of everything. Every stupid bacterium out there is going to kill us. Viruses are going to kill us. Eat a Twinkie and the sugar in that thing is going to kill you. We bought beliefs. And the reality is, if you believe that's true, then don't eat the Twinkie. Because if you believe it, even if the sugar would never do anything, if you believe it, then by eating a Twinkie, you will cause the biology to reflect a damage that you believe in.
Well, Bruce, I would say that anyone who's listened to this conversation today will probably have a shift in belief, at least be more aware that awareness is the key here.
Well, that's the nature of our future in this world that we're in, that we have to let go of the victimization thing, because from every level higher above us, and how did they get higher above us? Because they let us believe that we are victims and we need them. And it turns out we never needed them until we bought the belief we did. Self-healing is how you actually will heal in spite of the fact that medicine may get in the way. It's important to recognize that we are these very powerful people, and yet every program we got growing up is a disempowering program. In fact, in Australia and New Zealand, they actually refer to the concept that's called cutting the tall poppy. And what this really represents is when you grow poppies, they all grow about the same height, and every now and then you'll see some poppy shoot up about a foot or so above all the other ones, and it doesn't look as pretty in the garden. So what do? They cut the head off the tall poppy so they'll all be the same.
Okay.
And what does this mean in child development is that when children have abilities that transcend what are called the normal, there's a tendency to cut their head off and bring them down. Who do you think you are? What you do is, anybody that starts to exercise these abilities, the conventional community will actually try to negate their abilities so that everybody is the same at a disempowered level, rather than thinking about the other way. why don't we all then become the tall poppy? So all the poppies fall. And that would be a far better consequence than taking the tall ones and cutting their head off. Just take the lower ones and give them their power back and let them become the tall ones.
Yeah, create a new standard, I think.
And I think that's the future that's facing us right now.
I'm really appreciative that you're part of that reformation, Bruce.
I appreciate it personally as a student because I wasn't part of that. The science led me that way, and when the science led me that way, and the outcome of my life was so profoundly impacted by changing these beliefs, I just couldn't help myself but try to get everybody to at least stop long enough to recognize that you are truly powerful, that you can walk across fire.
I talked to two different people yesterday and attempted to translate my fresh learning from this material this week to them. And in just that process of sharing it, it helped to pull some of the pieces together too.
Well, this is what I like about it. I think what you'll see is when you go out, after taking this as a little bit of a filter to look at life, when you go out and interact with life, you see these patterns all of a sudden because they were there, but until you look for the pattern, they're invisible.
Life is such a magical mystery tour. I absolutely love being here.
So do I. More so that I got a little more control over it rather than being the victim I thought I was.
Yeah. Well, bravo.
Well, bravo for you for taking the opportunity to go outside the box and look at the heretic here and finding out maybe it wasn't so weird.
Quite relatable, actually.
Okay,
yes, indeed.
Great.
Bruce, thank you so much for being my guest.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's been a long listen. Thank you so much for listening in to my conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton from 2006, just after his book, The Biology of Belief, was released. And you can find out more about what Dr. Bruce Lipton is up to at brucelipton.com.